and promised to call later. At the car, Ozzie said, "You drive," and walked to the passenger door.
"Gladly. Where to?"
"Well, I haven't seen a bloody corpse in several hours, so let's have a look at Stuart. May he rest in peace. I doubt he's moved much. And I need to speak to the state boys. Surely they can't screw up a case like this. They're good boys, if you say so."
Tatum slammed the door and cranked the engine. Past the city limits, Ozzie said,
"It's 8:30, and I've been up since 3. Same here. Especially that bit about 8:30. And I've had no breakfast. I'm starving. What's open at this wonderful hour on the Sabbath?" "Well, Huey's is probably just now closing, and they don't do breakfast. What about Sawdust?"
"Sawdust?
Yep. As far as I know, it's the only place open this early on Sundays, at least in this part of the county. Well, I know I'll be welcome because they have a special door for me. Says, Negroes enter here. I heard they took that down. You ever been inside?"
"No, Deputy Tatum. I have never been inside the Sawdust Country Store. When I was a kid here, it was still used by the Klan for meetings that were not so secret. We may be living in 1990, but the people who shop and dine at Sawdust, along with those who sit by the old iron stove in the wintertime and tell nigger jokes, and those who chew tobacco on the front porch and spit on the gravel as they whittle and play checkers, are not the kind of people I want to hang with. They have great blueberry pancakes. They'll probably poison mine."
"No, they won't. Let's order the same thing, then swap after we're served. If I croak over and die, then Kofor and I can have a joint service. Damn, just think of the parade around the square."
"I really don't want to."
"Ozzie, you've been elected sheriff of Ford County by 2 landslides. You are the man around here, and I can't believe you're shy about walking into a public cafe and having a meal. If you're afraid, I promise I'll protect you."
"That's not the case."
"A question. How many white-owned businesses have you ducked and dodged since you ran for sheriff 7 years ago?"
"Well, I haven't been to all the white churches."
"That's because it's humanly impossible to visit them all. Must be 1,000 and they're still building. And I said businesses, not churches."
Ozzie pondered the question as they flew by small farms and pine forests. Finally, he said,
"Only one that I can think of."
"Then let's go."
"Is that Confederate flag still flying out front?"
"Probably."
"Who owns the place now?"
"I don't know. I haven't stopped by in a few years."
They crossed a creek and turned onto another county road. Tatum gunned the engine as he straddled the center line. The road saw little traffic on work days and was especially quiet on a Sunday morning.
Ozzie said, "Pine Grove precinct, 95% white, and only 30% voted for me."
30%?
"Yep.
I ever tell you about my mother's father? Grumps, they called him. Died before I was born, which was probably a good thing. Ran for sheriff in Tyler County 40 years ago and got 8% of the vote. So 30 is pretty impressive."
"It didn't feel too impressive on election night."
"Give it up, boss. You won big, and this is your chance to impress the enlightened people who dine at Sawdust."
"Why is it called Sawdust?"
"Bunch of sawmills around here, lots of loggers, tough guys. I don't know, but we're about to find out."
The parking lot was filled with pickups, some new, most old and dented, all parked haphazardly as if their drivers had sprinted to breakfast. An off-center flagpole hailed the great state of Mississippi and the glorious cause of the Confederacy. 2 black bears nuzzled each other in a cage next to the side porch. The planks creaked as Ozzie and Moss Jr. crossed them. The front door entered into a cramped country store with smoked meats hanging from the ceiling. The strong, heavy aroma of frying bacon and burning wood filled the air. Behind the counter, an old woman looked at Tatum, then at Ozzie, and managed to nod and say,
"Morning."
They spoke, kept walking, and entered the cafe in the rear, where half the tables were crowded with men. All white men. No women. They were eating and drinking coffee. Some were smoking, and all seemed to be chattering away until they saw Ozzie. There was a noticeable decline in the noise, but only for the second or two it took them to realize who he was and that both were officers. Then, as if to prove their tolerance, they picked up their conversations with even more vigor and tried to ignore them. Tatum waved to an empty table, and they sat down. Ozzie immediately busied himself with a thorough perusal of the menu, though it was unnecessary. A waitress arrived with a pot of coffee and filled their cups. A man at the nearest table looked for the second time, and Tatum pounced.
"This place used to have famous blueberry pancakes. That's still the case?"
"You betcha,"
the man said with a grin, then patted his ample stomach.
"That and venison sausage. Helps me keep my figure."
This got a laugh or two. Another man said,
"Say, we just heard about Stuart Cofer."
The room was instantly silent.
"Is it true?"
Tatum gave a quick nod to his boss as if to say, "This is your moment. Act like the high sheriff." Ozzie's back was turned to at least half of the diners, so he stood and looked at them all. He said,
"Yes, I'm afraid it's true. Stuart was shot and killed around 3 this morning at home. We've lost one of our best."
"Who shot him?"
"I can't go into the details right now. We may have more to say tomorrow. We heard it was a kid living with him." "Well, we've taken a 16-year-old boy into custody. The boy's mother was Kofa's girlfriend. That's all I can say. The state police are on the scene right now. Again, I can't say much. Maybe later."
Ozzie was smooth and friendly, and he could not have scripted what happened next. A rustic old man with dirty boots and faded overalls and a cap from a feed company said respectfully,
"Thank you, Sheriff."
There was a pause. The ice was broken, and several others offered their thanks, too. Ozzie sat down and ordered pancakes and sausage. As they drank coffee and waited, Tatum said,
"Not a bad campaign stop, huh, boss?"
"I never think about politics."
Tatum suppressed a laugh and looked away.
"You know, boss, if you came here once a month and had breakfast, you'd get every vote."
"Don't want every vote, just 70% of them."
The waitress laid a copy of the Sunday edition of the Jackson paper on the table and smiled at Ozzie. Tatum grabbed the sports section, and to pass the time, Ozzie read the state news. His eyes drifted above the print, and he noticed the wall to his right. In the center were two large 1990 football schedules, one for Ole Miss, one for Mississippi State, and around them were banners for both teams and framed black-and-white photos of yesterday's heroes in various action poses. All white, all from another era. Ozzie had starred at Clanton High and dreamed of being the first black player at Ole Miss, but he wasn't recruited. There were already two blacks in the program, and Ozzie had always quietly assumed that, at that time, two were enough. He signed instead with Alcorn State, started for 4 years, got drafted in the 10th round, and made the LA Rams roster his rookie year. He played in 11 games before a knee injury sent him back to Mississippi. He studied the faces of the old stars and wondered how many of them had actually played in a professional football game. Two other players from Ford County, both black, had made it professionally, but their photos were not on the wall either. He lifted the newspaper an inch or two and tried to read a story, but he was distracted. The conversations around him were about the weather, a coming storm, the bass biting in Lake Chatula, the death of an old farmer they all knew, and the latest stunts by their senators in Jackson. He listened carefully as he pretended to read and wondered what they would be discussing in his absence. Would they dwell on the same subjects? Probably so. Ozzie knew that in the late 1960s, the sawdust had been the gathering spot for white hotheads determined to build a private school in the wake of the Supreme Court's betrayals on desegregation. The school had been built on some donated land outside of Clanton, a simple metal building with low-paid teachers and cheap tuitions that were never cheap enough. It folded after a few years of rising debts and intense pressure for countywide support of the public schools. The pancakes and sausage arrived, and the waitress refilled their cups.
"You ever had venison sausage?" Tatum asked.
In his 40 or so years, he had barely set foot outside of Ford County, but he often assumed he knew far more than his boss, who had once traveled coast to coast in the NFL.
"My grandmother used to make it," Ozzie said. "I watched her."
He took a bite, considered it, said,
"Okay, a bit too spicy."
"I saw you looking at those photos on the wall. They need one of you, boss."
"Not really my hangout, Tatum. I can live without it."
"We'll see. It ain't right, you know. Drop it."
They dug into their tall stacks of pancakes, each enough for a family of four, and enjoyed a few bites. Then Tatum leaned in and asked,
"So, what are you thinking about a funeral and such?"
"I'm not family, Moss, in case you haven't noticed. I suppose that'll be up to his parents."
"Yeah, but you can't just have a service and lower him into the ground, right? Hell, he's a law enforcement officer, Ozzie. Don't we get parades and marching bands and drill teams and rifle salutes? I want a crowd, and I want some folks really tore up and carrying on when they bury me."
"Probably not gonna happen."
Ozzie lowered his knife and fork and slowly took a drink of coffee. He looked at his deputy as if he was in kindergarten and said,
"A slight distinction, Moss. Our buddy Kofa was not exactly killed in the line of duty. Indeed, he was off duty and in all likelihood had been drinking and carousing and who knows what else. It might be rather difficult to drum up support for a parade to send him off. What if the family wants a show? Look, they're still taking pictures of his dead body, so let's worry about it later, okay? Now eat. We need to hustle over there."
By the time they arrived at Stewart's house, Earl Kofer and his nephews were gone. At some point, they got tired of waiting and were probably needed back with the family. The driveway and front yard were crowded with police cars and official vehicles, two vans from the state crime lab, an ambulance waiting to haul Stewart away, another one with a crew just in case they were needed. Even a couple of volunteer fire department vehicles were in place to assist, as usual, with the congestion. Ozzie knew one of the state investigators and got a quick briefing, not that it was needed. They looked at Stewart again, in exactly the same spot as before, the only difference being the darkened shades of the blood on the sheets around him. The stained and spattered pillows were gone. Two technicians in head-to-toe hazmat garb were slowly lifting samples from the wall above the headboard.
"Fairly cut and dried, I'd say," the investigators said. "But we'll take him in anyway for a quick autopsy. I take it the kid is still in jail."
"Yep,"
Ozzie replied. Where else would the kid be? As always at these crime scenes, Ozzie found it difficult to stomach the arrogance of the state boys who rolled in with their airs of superiority. He wasn't required to call them to the scene, but in murder cases that led to murder trials, he had learned that jurors tend to be more impressed with experts from the state police. In the end, nothing mattered but convictions.
"Has he been printed?" the investigator asked. "No, we thought we'd let you guys do that." "Good. We'll go by the jail and fingerprint him and scan for gunshot residue. He's waiting."
They stepped outside where Tatum fired up a cigarette, and Ozzie took a paper cup of coffee from a fireman who had brought his thermos. They loitered a bit, with Ozzy trying to delay his next stop. The front door opened again, and a technician began backing out slowly, pulling the gurney with Stuart wrapped tightly in sheets. They rolled him down the brick walkway, lifted him into an ambulance, and closed the door. Earl and Janet Kofer lived a few miles away in a low-slung 1960s-style ranch house where they had raised three sons and a daughter. Stuart was their oldest child, and because of this, had inherited from his grandfather 10 wooded acres and the house where he lived and died. The Kofers as a clan were not wealthy and did not own a lot of land, but they had always worked hard, lived frugally, and tried to avoid trouble. And there were plenty of them, scattered around the southern part of the county. In his first run for public office in 1983, Ozzy was never certain how the family voted. However, 4 years later, and with Stuart wearing a uniform and driving a shiny patrol car, Ozzy got every vote in the family. They proudly displayed his yard signs and even wrote small checks for his campaign. Now, on this awful Sunday morning, they were all waiting for their sheriff to pay his respects and answer their questions. For a show of support, Ozzy had Tatum at the wheel, followed by a car with Looney and McCarver, two other white deputies. It was, after all, Mississippi, and Ozzy had learned where to use his white deputies and where to use his black ones. As expected, the long front drive was lined with cars and trucks. On the porch, one group of men smoked and waited. Not far away, under a sourwood tree, another group did the same. Tatum parked, and they got out and began walking across the front lawn as relatives stepped forward with their somber greetings. Ozzy and Tatum and Looney and McCarver worked their way toward the house, shaking hands, offering condolences, grieving with the family. Near the front, Earl stood and stepped down and thanked Ozzy for coming. His eyes were red and wounded, and he began sobbing again as Ozzy shook his hands with both of his and just listened. A crowd of men gathered around the sheriff and expected to hear something. Ozzy met their sad and troubled eyes, nodded, tried to appear just as hurt. He said,
"Really not much to add to what you already know. The call came across at 2:40 this morning. Call from the son of Josie Gamble. Said his mother had been beaten and he thought she was dead. When we got there, we found the mother unconscious in the kitchen, being tended to by her daughter, age 14. The daughter said her brother had shot Stuart. Then we found Stuart in the bedroom on his bed. A single gunshot to the head by his service pistol, which was on the bed. The boy, Drew, wouldn't talk, so we took him in. He's in jail now."
"No doubt it's the boy?" someone asked.
Ozzy shook his head. "No.
Look, I can't say much right now. Truth is, we don't know much more than what I just told you. I'm not sure there's that much more to it, really. Maybe we'll know something tomorrow."
"He ain't getting out of jail, right?" asked another.
"No, no way. I expect the court will appoint him a lawyer real soon, and at that point the system takes over."
"Will there be a trial?"
"I have no idea."
"How old is this boy?"
16. "Can they treat him like an adult, put his ass on death row?" "That's up to the court."
There was a pause as some of the men studied their feet while others wiped their eyes. Softly, Earl asked,
"Where's Stuart now?" "They're taking him to Jackson, State Crime Lab, for an autopsy. Then they'll release him to you and Mrs. Kofa. I'd like to see Janet, if that's okay."
Earl said,
"I don't know, Sheriff. She's in bed and surrounded by her sisters. I'm not sure she wants to see anybody. Give her some time." "Of course. Please pass along my condolences."
Two other cars were arriving, and out on the highway another had slowed. Ozzie killed a few awkward minutes and then excused himself. Earl and the others thanked him for coming. He promised to call tomorrow and keep them informed. Chapter 4. 6 days a week, every day but Sunday, Jake Brigance allowed himself to be dragged out of bed at the unholy hour of 5:30 a.m. by a noisy alarm clock. 6 days a week, he went straight to the coffee pot, punched a button, then hurried to his own private little bathroom in the basement, far away from his sleeping wife and daughter, where he showered in 5 minutes and spent another five with the rest of his ritual before dressing in the clothes he'd laid out the night before. He then hurried upstairs, poured a cup of black coffee, eased back into his bedroom, kissed his wife goodbye, grabbed his coffee, and at precisely 5:45, closed the kitchen door and stepped onto the rear patio. 6 days a week, he drove the dark streets of Clanton to the picturesque square with the stately courthouse anchoring life as he knew it, parked in front of his office on Washington Street, and at 6 a.m., 6 days a week, walked into the coffee shop to either hear or create the gossip and to dine on wheat toast and grits. But on the seventh day, he rested. There was never an alarm clock on the Sabbath, and Jake and Carla reveled in a long morning's rest. He would eventually stumble forth around 7:30 and order her back to sleep. In the kitchen, he poached eggs and toasted bread and served her breakfast in bed with coffee and juice on a normal Sunday. But nothing about this day would be normal. At 7:05, the phone rang, and since Carla insisted that the phone be located on his night table, he had no choice but to answer it.
"If I were you, I'd leave town for a couple of days."
It was the low, raspy voice of Harry Rex Vonner, perhaps his best friend and sometimes his only one.
"Well, good morning, Harry Rex. This better be good."
Harry Rex, a gifted and devious divorce lawyer, ran in the dark shadows of Ford County and took enormous pride in knowing the news, the dirt, and the gossip before almost anyone not wearing a badge.
"Stuart Kofa got shot in the head last night. Dead. Ozzie picked up his girlfriend's boy, 16-year-old kid without a trace of peach fuzz, and he's at the jail just waiting on a lawyer. I'm sure Judge Noose knows about it and is already thinking about the appointment."
Jake sat up and propped up his pillows. "Stuart Kofa is dead?"
"Deader than hell. Kid blew his brains out while he was sleeping. Capital, dude. Death penalty and all. Killing a cop will get you the gas 9 times out of 10 in this state."
"Didn't you handle a divorce for him?"
"His first one, not his second. He got pissed off about my fee and became a disgruntled client. When he called about the second, I told him to get lost. Married a couple of crazies, but then he had a fondness for bad women, especially in tight jeans."
"Any kids?"
"None that I know of. None that he knew of either."
Carla scurried out of bed and stood beside it. She frowned at Jake as if someone was lying. 3 weeks earlier, Officer Stuart Kofa had visited her class of sixth graders and given a wonderful presentation on the dangers of illegal drugs.
"But he's only 16, Jake said, scratching his eyes.
"Spoken like a true liberal defense lawyer. Noose will be calling you before you know it, Jake. Think about it. Who tried the last capital murder case in Ford County? You, Carl Lee Haley. But that was 5 years ago. Doesn't matter. Name another lawyer around here who'll even think about taking a serious criminal case. Nobody. And more important, Jake, there's no one else in the county who's competent enough to take a capital case."
"No way. What about Jack Walter?"
"He's back in the sauce. Noose got 2 complaints last month from disgruntled clients, and he's about to notify the state bar."
How Harry Rex knew such things was always a marvel to Jake.
"I thought they sent him away."
"They did, but he came back thirstier than ever." What about Gil Maynard? He got burned in that rape case last year. Told Noose he'd surrender his license before he got stuck with another bad criminal appointment. And he's pretty awful on his feet. Noose was beyond frustrated with the guy in the courtroom. Give me another name. Okay. Let me think a minute. A waste of time. I'm telling you, Jake. Noose will call you sometime today. Can you leave the country for a week or so?
Don't be ridiculous, Harry Rex. We have motions before Noose at 10 Tuesday morning. The rather insignificant matter of the Smallwood case. Remember that one?
Damn it, I thought it was next week.
Good thing I'm in charge of the case. Not to mention such trivial matters as Carla and her job and Hannah and her classes. It's silly to think we can just disappear. I'm not running, Harry Rex.
You'll wish you had, believe me. This case is nothing but trouble.
If Noose calls, I'll talk to him and explain why I can't get involved. I'll suggest that he appoint someone from another county. He likes those two guys in Oxford who'll take anything, and he's brought them in before.
Last I heard, they're swamped with death row appeals. They always lose at trial, you know, makes the appellate stuff go on forever. Listen to me, Jake. You do not want a dead cop case. The facts are against you. The politics are against you. There's not a chance in hell the jury will show any sympathy.
Got it, Harry Rex. Let me drink some coffee and talk to Carla.
Is she in the shower?
Well, no.
That's my favorite fantasy, you know.
Later, Harry Rex. Jake hung up and followed Carla to the kitchen, where they brewed coffee. The spring morning was almost warm enough to sit on the patio, but not quite. They settled around a small table in the breakfast nook, with a pleasant view of the pink and white azaleas blooming in the backyard. The dog, a recent rescue effort they called Mully, but who, so far answered to nothing except food, emerged from his turf in the washroom and stared at the patio door. Jake led him outside and poured two cups. Over coffee, he repeated everything Harry Rex said, except the parting shot about Carla in the shower, and they discussed the unpleasant possibility of getting dragged into the case. Jake agreed that the Honorable Omar Noose, his friend and mentor, was unlikely to appoint another lawyer from the rather shallow pool of talent that was the Ford County Bar. Almost to a man, or to a person, since there was now one female lawyer, they avoided jury trials, preferring instead to do the paperwork required of their quiet little office practices. Harry Rex was always up to a good courtroom brawl, but only in domestic relations cases, tried before judges, no juries. 95% of the criminal cases were settled with plea bargains, thus avoiding trials. Small tort cases, car wrecks, slip and falls, dog bites were negotiated with the insurance companies. Usually, if a Ford County lawyer stumbled onto a big civil case, he rushed to Tupelo or Oxford and associated a real trial lawyer, one experienced in litigation and not terrified of juries. Jake still dreamed of changing this, and at the age of 37, he was trying to establish a reputation as a lawyer who gambled and got verdicts. Without a doubt, his most glorious moment had been the not guilty verdict for Carl Lee Haley 5 years earlier, and he had been certain in its aftermath that the big cases would find their way to his door. They had not. He still threatened to try every dispute, and this worked well, but the rewards were still paltry. The Smallwood case, though, was different. It had the potential of being the biggest civil case in the county's history, and Jake was the lead counsel. He had filed the lawsuit 13 months earlier and had since spent half of his time working on it. He was now ready for the trial and yelling at the defense lawyers for a date. Harry Rex had not mentioned the role of the county's part-time public defender, and with good reason. The current PD was a bashful rookie whose early job approval ratings were about as low as they could get. He took the job because no one else wanted it, and because the position had been vacant for a year, and because the county reluctantly agreed to increase the salary to $2,500 a month. No one expected him to survive another year. He had yet to try a case all the way to a jury's verdict and showed no interest in doing so. And most important, he had never even watched a capital murder trial. Not surprisingly, Carla immediately felt sympathy for the woman. Even though she had liked Stu Kofer, she also knew that some off-duty cops could behave as badly as anyone. And if domestic violence was a factor, the facts would only become more complicated. But she was wary of another high-profile, controversial case. For 3 years after the trial of Carl Lee Haley, the Brigance family had lived with a deputy parked in front of their house at night, and threatening phone calls and hateful glares from strangers in stores. Now, in another nice home, and with that case even further behind them, they were slowly adjusting to a normal life. Jake still carried a registered gun in his car, which she frowned on, but the surveillance was gone. They were determined to enjoy the present, plan for the future, and forget the past. The last case Carla wanted was one that might attract headlines. As they were chatting quietly, Miss Hannah appeared in her pajamas, sleepy-eyed and clutching still her favorite stuffed cub, one that she had never slept without. The cub was threadbare and far past its useful shelf life, and Hannah was 9 years old and needed to move on. But a serious discussion about such a transition was being postponed. She crawled into her father's lap and closed her eyes again. Like her mother, she preferred a quiet entry into the morning with as little noise as possible. Her parents stopped talking about the legal stuff and switched to Hannah's Sunday school lesson, one she had not yet read. Carla disappeared and returned with the study guide, and Jake began reading about Jonah and the whale, one of his least favorite Bible stories. Hannah wasn't impressed with it either and seemed to doze. Carla busied herself in the kitchen with breakfast, oatmeal for Hannah, poached eggs and wheat toast for the adults. They ate quietly and enjoyed the peaceful moments together. Cartoons on television were usually prohibited on Sundays, and Hannah didn't think to ask. She ate little, as usual, and reluctantly left the table for a bath. At 9:45, they were dressed in their Sunday finest and headed for worship at the First Presbyterian Church. Once loaded in the car, Jake couldn't find his sunglasses and hustled back inside, turning off the ever-present alarm system as he entered. The phone on the kitchen wall started ringing, and the caller ID flashed a number. Same area code, but a different prefix that looked familiar. Could be Van Buren County, next door. No name, caller unknown. But Jake had a hunch. He stared at the phone, either unable or unwilling to answer, because something told him not to. Besides Harry Rex, who dared call on a peaceful Sunday morning? Lucian Wilbanks, maybe? But it wasn't him. It must be important, and it must be trouble. And for seconds, he just stood there gawking at the phone, transfixed. After the max of 8 rings, he waited for the recording light to blink and punched a button. A familiar voice said,
"Good morning, Jake. It's Judge Noose. I'm at home in Chester and headed for church. You probably are, too, and I'm sorry to disturb, but there's an urgent matter in Clanton, and I'm sure you've heard about it by now. Please call me as soon as possible."
And the line went dead. He would remember that moment for a long time, standing in his kitchen, dressed in a dark suit as if filled with confidence and staring at the telephone because he was too afraid to answer it. He could not remember ever feeling like such a coward and vowed that it would never happen again. He set the alarm, locked the door, and walked to the car with a big fake smile for his girls and got in. As he backed out of the drive, Hannah asked,
"Where are your sunglasses, Daddy?"
"Oh, I couldn't find them."
"They were on the counter by the mail,"
Carla said. He shook his head as if it didn't matter and said, "Didn't see them, and we're running late." The lesson in the men's Bible class was a continuation of the study of Paul's letter to the Galatians, but they never got around to it. A policeman had been murdered. A local boy whose parents and grandparents were from the county, along with other family members scattered about. Much of the discussion was about crime and punishment, with the mood running strongly in favor of swift retribution, regardless of how young the killer might be. Did it really matter if he was 16 or 60? It certainly didn't matter to Stu Kofer, whose stock seemed to rise by the hour. A bad kid pulling a trigger can do just as much damage as a serial killer. There were three lawyers in the class, and the other two held forth with no shortage of opinions. Jake was passive, but deep in thought, and tried not to appear troubled. His Presbyterian brethren were considered a bit more tolerant than the fundamentalists down the street, the Baptists and Pentecostals who loved the death penalty. But judging by the thirst for vengeance in the small classroom, Jake figured the boy who killed Stu Kofer was headed to the gas chamber at Parchman. He kept trying to dismiss it all because it would be someone else's problem, right? At 10:45, with the pipe organ roaring away and calling all to worship, Jake and Carla made their way down the aisle to the fourth pew from the front, right side, and waited for Hannah to come bouncing in from her Sunday school class. Jake chatted with old friends and acquaintances, most of whom he rarely saw outside of church. Carla said hello to two of her students. First Presbyterian averaged 250 congregants for the morning service, and it seemed as if most were milling around and exchanging greetings. There was a lot of gray hair, and Jake knew their minister was concerned about the flagging popularity of worship among younger families. Old Mr. Kavanaugh, a perpetual grouch who most people tried to avoid, but who wrote bigger checks than any other member, grabbed Jake by the arm and said, much too loudly, "You ain't getting involved with that boy who killed our deputy, are you?" Oh, the retorts he would love to use. First, why can't you ever mind your own business, you cranky old bastard? Second, you and your family have never thrown me a dime in legal work, so why are you now concerned with my law practice? Third, how can the case possibly affect you? Instead, Jake looked him square in the eye and, without a trace of a smile, replied, "Which deputy are you talking about?" Mr. Kavanaugh was taken aback, paused just long enough for Jake to free his arm, and managed to ask, "Oh, you haven't heard?" "Heard what?" The choir erupted in a call to worship, and it was time to be seated. Hannah appeared and wedged herself between her parents, and not for the first time, Jake smiled at her and wondered how long these days would last. She would soon start bugging them to let her sit with her friends during big church. And then, not long after that, boys would enter the picture. "Don't look for trouble," Jake reminded himself. "Just enjoy the moment." The moments, though, were difficult to enjoy. Not long after the preliminary announcements and the first hymn, Dr. Eli Proctor assumed the pulpit and delivered the somber news that everyone already knew. With a bit too much drama, at least in Jake's opinion, the pastor told of the tragic loss of Officer Stuart Kofer, as if in some way it directly affected him. It was an irritating habit, one that Jake occasionally mentioned to Carla, though she had no patience for his complaints. Proctor could almost cry when describing typhoons in the South Pacific or famines in Africa, disasters that no doubt deserved the prayers of all Christians, but were on the other side of the world. The pastor's only connection was the cable news shared by the rest of the country. He managed, though, to be more profoundly touched. He prayed long and hard for justice and healing, but was a bit light on mercy. The youth choir sang two hymns, and the service switched gears. When the sermon started at precisely 11:32 by Jake's watch, He tried gamely to absorb the opening paragraph, but was soon lost in the near dizzying scenarios that might be played out in the days to come. He would call Noose after lunch. That much was certain. He had great respect and admiration for his judge, and this was strengthened by the fact that Noose felt the same way about him. As a young lawyer, Noose had gotten himself involved in politics and gone astray. As a state senator, he had narrowly missed an indictment and was humiliated at re-election time. He once told Jake that he had wasted his formative years as a young lawyer and had never honed his courtroom skills. With great pride, he had watched Jake grow up in the courtroom and still relished his not guilty verdict in the Haley trial. Jake knew it would be next to impossible to say no to the Honorable Omar Noose. And if he said yes and agreed to represent the kid? That kid sitting over there in the jail in the juvie cell that Jake had visited many times? What would these fine folks, these devout Presbyterians, think of him? How many of them had ever seen the inside of a jail? How many had an inkling of how the system worked? And crucially, how many of these fine, law-abiding citizens believed every defendant had the right to a fair trial? And the word fair was supposed to include the assistance of a good lawyer. The common question was, how can you represent a man who's guilty of a serious crime? His common response was, if your father or son was charged with a serious crime, would you want an aggressive lawyer or a pushover? Typically, and with no small measure of frustration, he was again busying himself with thoughts about what others might think. A serious flaw for any lawyer, at least according to the great Lucian Wilbanks, a man who had never worried about the concerns of others. When Jake finished law school and found himself working in the Wilbanks law firm under Lucian's tutelage, his boss had proclaimed such gems as, "Those pricks down at the Rotary Club and the church and the coffee shop will not make you a lawyer and will not make you a dime." And, "To be a real lawyer, first you grow a thick skin, and second, you tell everybody but your clients to go to hell." And, "A real lawyer is not afraid of unpopular cases." Such was the atmosphere of Jake's apprenticeship. Before he was disbarred for all manner of bad behavior, Lucian was a successful lawyer who made a name for himself representing the underdogs. Minorities, unions, poor school districts, abandoned kids, the homeless. Because of his brazenness, though, and his self-awareness issues, he often failed to connect with juries. Jake pinched himself and wondered why he was thinking of Lucian during the sermon. Because if he still had a license to practice law, Lucian would be calling Noose and demanding that he, Lucian, be appointed to represent the kid. And since all other locals were running from the case, Noose would appoint Lucian, and everyone would be pleased.
"Take the damn case, Jake," he could hear him yelling. "Every person is entitled to a lawyer. You can't always pick your clients."
Carla realized he was drifting and shot him a look. He smiled and patted Hannah's knee, but she quickly shoved his hand away. After all, she was 9 years old. In the parlance of the Bible Belt, those within the faith used many words and terms to describe those outside of it. On the harsher end of the spectrum, the lost were referred to as heathen, unsaved, unclean, hell-bound, and just old-fashioned sinners. More polite Christians called them non-believers, future saints, backsliders, or the favorite, unchurched. Whatever the term, it was safe to say that the Kofers had been unchurched for decades. Some distant cousins were members of congregations, but as a rule, they as a clan had avoided involvement with the word. They were not bad people. They had just never felt the need to pursue the holier way. They had had their chances. Dozens of well-meaning country preachers had tried to reach them, to no avail. and it was not unusual for traveling evangelists to target them and even call them by name in fiery sermons. They had often been at the top of prayer lists and subjected to door-to-door solicitations. Through it all, they had resisted all efforts to follow the Lord and were quite content to be left alone. On that somber morning, though, they needed the embrace and sympathy of their neighbors. They needed the usual outpouring of love and compassion of those closer to God, and it wasn't there. Instead, they huddled en masse at Earl's home and tried to cope with the unimaginable. The women sat and cried with Janet, Stu's mother, while the men stayed outside on the porch and under the trees, smoking, cursing quietly, and talking of revenge. The Good Shepherd Bible Church met in a picturesque white frame building with a tall steeple and a manicured cemetery behind it. The building was historic, 160 years old, and had been built by Methodists, who handed it down to some Baptists, who disbanded and left it vacant for 30 years. The church's founders had been an independent group, not fond of denominational labels and the rampant fundamentalism and political leanings that had swept through the South in the 1970s. The church, with about 100 members, had bought the building out of foreclosure, renovated it with great care, and welcomed more enlightened souls who were weary of the prevailing dogma. Women were elected as elders, a radical notion that gave rise to the whispered claim that Good Shepherd was a cult. Blacks and all minorities were welcome, though they worshipped elsewhere for other reasons. On that Sunday morning, attendance was up slightly as the members met to learn the latest details of the killing. Once Pastor Charles McGarry let it be known that the accused, young Drew Gamble, was practically one of them, and that his mother Josie was in the hospital badly injured after a brutal beating, the church circled its wagons and embraced the family. Kira, still in the jeans and sneakers she wore during the terrible ordeal of the night before, sat through Sunday school in a small classroom with other teenage girls and tried to comprehend where she was. Her mother was in the hospital, and her brother was in the jail. And she had already been told that she could not go back to the house to gather her things. She tried not to cry, but couldn't help herself. During the worship hour, she sat on the front pew with the pastor's wife on one side, holding her arm, and a girl she knew from school close on the other. She managed to stop the tears, but she couldn't think clearly. She stood for the hymns, old songs she had never heard before, and she closed her eyes tight and tried to pray along with Pastor Charles. She listened to his sermon, but heard nothing. She had not eaten in hours, but had declined food. She could not imagine going to school tomorrow and decided she would not be forced to do so. All Kira wanted was to sit on the edge of her mother's hospital bed with her brother on the opposite side and touch her arms. Chapter 5. Sunday lunch was a light salad and soup, the usual unless Jake's mother was in the mood to put on a spread, a treat that happened about once a month, but not today. After a quick lunch, he helped Carla clear the table and stack the dishes and toyed with the idea of a Sunday nap. But Hannah had other plans. She wanted to take Mully for a walk to the city park, and Carla volunteered Jake for the adventure. He was fine with it. Anything to kill time and avoid the return call to Judge Noose. By 2, he was back, and Hannah disappeared into her room. Carla boiled water and served them green tea at the breakfast table. She asked, "He can't make you take the case, can he?" "I really don't know. I thought about it all morning, and I can't remember a case where the court tried to appoint a lawyer and he refused. Circuit judges have enormous power, and I suppose News could make my life miserable if I said no. Frankly, that's why you don't say no. A small-town lawyer is dead if he alienates his judges.
And you're worried about Smallwood?
Of course I'm worried about it. Discovery is almost complete, and I'm pestering Noose for a trial date. The defense is stalling, as always, but I think we have them on the run. Harry Rex thinks they might be ready to talk settlement, but not until they're staring at a firm trial date. We need to keep Noose happy.
Are you saying he might carry a grudge from one case to the next?
Omar Noose is a wonderful old judge who almost always gets it right. But he can also be prickly. He's human and makes mistakes. And he's also accustomed to getting whatever he wants, at least in his own courtroom.
So he would allow one case to affect another?
Yes, it has happened.
But he likes you, Jake.
He sees himself as my mentor, and he wants me to do great things, and that's a perfect reason to keep the old guy happy.
Do I get a vote in this?
Always.
Okay. This is not the Haley case. There is no racial tension here. As far as I know, everybody is white, right?
So far.
So the Klan and those crazies won't show up this time. To be sure, you'll rankle some people who want to string the kid up right now, and they'll resent any lawyer who takes his case. But doesn't that go with the territory? You're a lawyer. The best, in my opinion. And right now, there's a 16-year-old boy in serious trouble, and he needs help.
There are other lawyers in town.
And which one would you hire if you were facing the death penalty?
Jake hesitated too long, and she said,
See?
Tom Motley is a promising trial lawyer.
And one who doesn't get his hands dirty on the criminal side. How many times have I heard you give that rant?
Bo Landis is good.
Who? I'm sure he's great, but his name doesn't ring a bell.
He's young.
And you would trust him with your life?
I didn't say that. Look, Carla, I'm not the only lawyer in town, and I'm sure Noose can twist somebody else's arm. It's not uncommon in nasty cases like this to appoint a lawyer from outside the county. Remember that terrible rape out in Box Hill 3 or 4 years ago?
Sure.
Well, we begged off, and Noose protected us by hooking in a lawyer from Tupelo. No one here knew him, and he handled it as well as could be expected. Bad facts.
And that was a plea bargain, right?
Yes. 30 years in prison.
Not enough. What are the chances of a plea bargain in this case?
Who knows? We're talking about a minor, so Noose might cut him some slack. But there'll be a big push for blood. The death penalty. The victim's family will make noise. Ozzie will want a big trial because one of his boys is dead. Everybody's up for re-election next year, so it's a perfect moment to get tough on crime.
It doesn't seem right to send a 16-year-old kid to death row.
Try telling that to the Kofor family. Don't know them, but I'll bet they're thinking about the gas chamber. If some guy harmed Hannah, you wouldn't be too concerned about his age, would you?
Probably not.
They took a deep breath and allowed this sobering thought to pass. I thought you were ready to vote, Jake said.
I don't know, Jake. It's a tough call. But if Judge Noose pushes hard, I don't see how you can say no.
The phone rang, and they stared at it. Jake walked over and looked at the caller ID. He smiled at Carla and said, It's him. Jake grabbed the receiver, said hello, then pulled the cord halfway across the kitchen and took a seat with his wife at the breakfast table. They waded through the pleasantries. Families were all fine. The weather was changing. Terrible news about Stuart Kofor. They both professed admiration. Noose had spoken to Ozzie, and Ozzie had the kid locked away, safe and secure. Good old Ozzie. Most sheriffs Noose dealt with would have had the kid on the rack and signing a 10-page confession. Hitting his stride, Noose said,
Jake, I want you to represent this kid through the preliminaries. Don't know if it'll turn into a capital case, but that's always a real possibility. Nobody else in Clanton has any recent experience with the death penalty,
and you're the lawyer I trust the most. If it goes capital, then we'll revisit your representation and I'll try to find someone else.
Jake closed his eyes and nodded, and at the first pause jumped in.
Judge, you and I both know that if I step in now, there's an excellent chance I'll be stuck with it all the way.
Not necessarily, Jake. I just spoke with Roy Brown and over in Oxford. Damn fine lawyer. You know him, Jake?
Everybody knows Roy, Judge. He has 2 capital trials this year and is swamped, but he has a young partner who he thinks highly of. He promised me they would take a look at the case down the road if it goes capital. Right now, though, Jake, I want someone in that jail talking to the kid and keeping the police away from him. I don't want to be faced with some bogus confession or a jailhouse snitch.
I trust Ozzie.
And so do I, Jake. But this is a dead policeman, and you know how worked up those boys can get. I would just feel better if that kid had some protection right now. I'll make the appointment good for 30 days. You get over there and see the kid, then we'll meet at 9 Tuesday morning before the civil docket. I believe you have motions pending in the Smallwood case.
But I knew the victim, Judge.
So what? It's a small town and everybody knows everybody, right?
You're pushing pretty hard, Judge.
I'm sorry, Jake, and sorry to be bothering you on a Sunday, but this situation can get dicey and needs a steady hand. I trust you, Jake, and that's why I'm asking you to step in. You know, Jake, when I was a young lawyer, I learned that we don't always get to choose our clients, right?
And why not? Jake asked himself. I'd like to discuss this with my wife, Judge. As you know, we went through a lot 5 years ago with Haley, and she may have an opinion or two.
This is nothing like Haley, Jake.
No, but it is a dead policeman. And any lawyer who represents the alleged killer will face a backlash from the community. As you say, it's a small town, Judge.
I really want you to step up to the plate here, Jake.
I'll discuss it with Carla, and I'll see you first thing Tuesday morning, if that's all right.
The kid needs a lawyer now, Jake. As I understand things, he has no father, and his mother is in the hospital with injuries. There's no other family in the area. He's already admitted to the killing, so he needs to shut up. Yes, we both trust Ozzy, but I'm sure there are some hotheads around the jail who cannot be trusted. Discuss it with your wife, and call me back in a couple of hours.
There was a loud click, and the line was dead. His Honor had just given an order and hung up. The March winds picked up late in the afternoon, and the temperature dropped. With his girls lost in an old movie in the den, Jake left his house and went for a long walk through the quiet streets of Clanton. He often spent an hour or two alone in his office late on Sundays, reviewing the files he had not managed to close the previous week and deciding which ones to postpone next. At the moment, he had 80 open files, but only a handful were decent cases. Such was the practice of law in a small, poor town. These days, his world was consumed with Smallwood, and most other matters were being ignored. The facts were as simple as they were complicated. Taylor Smallwood, his wife Sarah, and 2 of their 3 children were killed instantly when their small import collided with a train at a dangerous crossing near the Polk County line. The accident happened around 10:30 on a Friday night. A witness in a pickup truck 100 yards behind the family said the red flashing crossing lights were not working at the time of the collision. The train's engineer and brakeman swore that they were. The crossing was at the foot of a hill that dropped 50 degrees from a crest half a mile up. 2 months earlier, Sarah had given birth to their 3rd child, Grace. At the time of the accident, Grace was being kept by Taylor's sister, who lived in Clanton. Typically, such a sensational accident sent the local bar into a frenzy as every lawyer in town searched for an angle to land the case. Jake had never heard of the family and struck out immediately. Harry Rex, though, had handled a divorce for Sarah's sister, and she was pleased with the results. As the vultures were circling, He struck quick and got a contract signed by various family members. He then dashed to the courthouse, set up a guardianship for Grace, the sole heir and plaintiff, and filed a $10 million lawsuit against the railroad, Central and Southern. Harry Rex knew his limitations and realized that he might not connect with jurors. He had a much better plan. He offered Jake half the fee if he would step in as lead counsel, do the heavy lifting, and push hard for a trial. Harry Rex had seen the magic with the Haley jury. He had sat mesmerized like everyone else as Jake pleaded for his client's life. And he knew that his younger friend had a way with jurors. If Jake could just land the right cases, he would someday make a lot of money in the courtroom. They shook hands on the deal. Jake would take an aggressive role and lean on Judge Noose to speed things along. Harry Rex would work in the shadows, plowing through discovery, hiring experts, intimidating insurance lawyers, and most important, picking the jury. They worked well together, primarily because they gave each other plenty of room. The railroad tried to remove the case to federal court, a less friendly jurisdiction. But Jake blocked the move with a series of motions that Noose granted. So far, their judge had shown little patience with the defense lawyers and their usual stalling tactics. The strategy was straightforward. Just prove the crossing was dangerous, badly designed, not properly maintained, well known as a place of near misses, and that the warning lights had failed that night. The defense was just as simple. Taylor Smallwood hit the 14th boxcar without ever touching his brakes. How do you not see, whether at night or in clear daylight, a railroad boxcar that is 15 feet tall, 40 feet long, and covered with bright yellow reflective warning stickers? The plaintiff had a strong case because the damages were enormous. The defense had a strong case because of the obvious facts. For almost a year, the railroad's insurance lawyers had refused to discuss settlement. However, now that the judge was setting a trial date, Harry Rex believed some money might be on the table. One of the defense lawyers was an acquaintance from law school, and they had been drinking together. Jake preferred his office when it was empty, which was rare these days. His current secretary was Portia Lang, a 26-year-old Army veteran who would be leaving in 6 months to start law school at Ole Miss. Portia's mother, Letty, had inherited a small fortune in a will dispute 2 years earlier, and Jake had battled an entire squad of lawyers to uphold the will. Portia had been so inspired by the case that she decided to go to law school. Her dream was to become the first black female lawyer in Ford County, and she was well on her way. Far more than a secretary, Portia not only answered the phone and ran interference with the clients and foot traffic, she was also learning legal research and wrote clearly. They were negotiating a deal in which she would continue to work part-time while in school, but both knew it would be nearly impossible the first year. To complicate their lives, Lucian Wilbanks, the owner of the building and former owner of the law firm, was now in the habit of arriving for work at least 3 mornings each week and generally making a nuisance of himself. Disbarred years earlier, Lucian could not take cases or represent clients, so he spent too much of his time sticking his nose into Jake's business and unloading unsolicited advice. He often claimed to be studying for the bar exam, a monumental challenge for an old man with much of his mental strength sapped by years of heavy drinking. Lucian claimed that by keeping hours at the office, he stayed away from the whiskey cabinet at home. But before long, he was sipping at his desk. He had assumed ownership of a small downstairs conference room far away from Jake, but too close to Portia, and usually spent the afternoon snoring off his liquid lunches with his feet on his desk. Lucian had made one crude comment of a sexual nature to Portia, after which she threatened to break his neck. They had been civil ever since, though she was happier when he was absent. To round out the firm's lineup, most of the typing was being done by a 20-hour-a-week former client named Beverly, a perfectly nice lady of middle age whose entire existence revolved around smoking cigarettes. She chain-smoked, knew the habit was killing her, and had tried every gimmick on the market to quit. The addiction prevented her from keeping a full-time job and a husband. Jake fixed her an office behind the kitchen where all the windows and doors could be left open and she could peck away in a blue haze. Even then, everything she touched reeked of stale smoke, and Jake was worried about how long she would last. He quietly speculated to Portia that lung cancer might get her before he was forced to terminate her employment. But Portia did not complain, nor did Lucian, who still smoked cigars on his porch and often smelled of old fumes himself. Jake eased upstairs to his grand office and did not turn on the lights because he did not want to attract attention. Even on Sunday afternoons, he had heard people knocking on his door. Not often, though. Not often enough. Some days he wondered where the next clients were coming from. Others, he wanted to get rid of all of them. In the semi-darkness, he stretched out on the old leather sofa purchased by the Wilbanks brothers decades earlier, and he stared at the dusty fan hanging from the ceiling and wondered how long it had been there. How much of the practice of law had changed over the years? What were the ethical dilemmas faced by those lawyers back then? Did they worry about taking unpopular cases? Were they afraid of a backlash if they represented murderers? Jake chuckled at the stories he'd heard about Lucian. He had been the first, and for years the only, white member of the county's chapter of the